You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, what was it like to play in the ABA? All right, hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast at HarvardParoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann, and we're continuing our series of basketball mysteries of the 1970s, and we have a couple very special guests today talking about what it was like to play in the ABA. First guest, he actually played in the ABA, Bob Nedelicki. He played almost the entire existence of the ABA, mostly with the Indiana Pacers. He was a four-time All-Star, two-time ABA champion who averaged 16 points per game and 8.9 rebounds in his career. Bob, welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be here.
And we also have with us Ted Green. He is a board member of the Dropping Dimes Foundation and a filmmaker who has produced documentaries on Pacers legends Slick Leonard and Roger Brown. And we'll talk a lot about Dropping Dimes later on and the work that they're doing with former ABA players, and appreciate them with connecting us with you guys. And definitely worthy cause that we'll talk quite a bit about. But I want to talk about with Bob first, who had a great career in the ABA. And you know, Bob, when you first were making the choice, you joined the ABA in its first season. It was a brand new league, a startup competing with the established ABA. What led you to join the Pacers and to take the plunge in a new league over the established NBA?
Well, you have to remember back then, you probably can't because you're way too young. In 1966, there was only 8 teams in the NBA, and the NBA was about as popular as watching feeding sparrows in the morning with grass seed. I mean, there was no television, there was no PR. Every once in a while, you'd hear about Bill Russell playing Will Chamberlain. And that was about it. It was an East Coast game, very little national coverage, if any at all. So when the ABA drafted me, during my college years, I never even gave it a thought to play in the NBA like they do today. I mean, when the kids are 12 years old, they're playing their NBA careers. But back when I played in high school, you didn't even know the NBA existed. So what it was is I got drafted by the Pacers. And then I got drafted by the San Diego Rockets in the NBA. It basically just came down to dollars. I went and saw the people over in the Pacers, and I was contacted by San Diego, and the Pacers offered me a much better deal. Of course, back then, a much better deal was $17,000 versus $12,000 a year, but kind of crazy in today's figures, but that was really good money back then. I mean, first round draft choices back then were getting 20-25 grand, and so I thought I did pretty good because I not only got that, but I got a bonus and I got the use of a car for a year. So it was strictly money, but it was the best choice I ever made because the ABA really changed basketball as we know it. And you know, when I started, there was only 20 teams in both leagues. So there's 30 now with 15 players apiece. We were only allowed 10 a team. So it was a lot smaller player pool, and I think the talent was great, and the whole league was a lot of fun. And we can look back saying, you know, what we think we did for the game of basketball.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that's important about the ABA is that it brought to light a lot of talent that hadn't had a chance in the NBA for various reasons, whether there weren't spots or for guys like Roger Brown or Doug Moe or Connie Hawkins, who had been tenuously tied to some gambling scandals and had been blackballed unfairly by the NBA. And
right, that was a ridiculous time in sports. I mean, back then the people that actually barred Roger Brown, I think the commissioner, I can't remember his name, but I think he was 3 foot tall and didn't even know what a basketball looked like. He barred Roger Brown and Doug Moe without any proof, without anything, just a hearsay. And of course, Roger Brown, in my personal opinion, had he been able to play college ball, him and Connie both, and going to the NBA, right? You'd be talking to Roger Brown in the same words as you would Michael Jordan and Jerry West, to people like that. Absolutely no doubt about that. And it gave a lot of people a lot of chances, because you just figure in 66 there's 8 teams, that's 80 players. Now, there was more than 80 very good players in the country back then. The problem was there just wasn't enough spot. And, you know, they could only have 80 players. And all of a sudden, there's this new league opens up, and now there's 200 players. But what they're finding out is most of those 200 players are just as good as the ones that were playing in the NBA.
So Ted, talking about Roger Brown, one of the documentaries that you produced was on Roger. And, you know, what were his specific skills and what stood out to him as a player and as a person?
Well, it's kind of funny because what his skills started out as, and Donnie Walsh talks about this. Donnie Walsh played against him back in their high school days in New York City. They actually a place called Kutcher's, where they would go during the summers, and they played on the same team. And Donnie just raves about him. But back then, Roger just jumped out of the gym. I mean, he set the New York City high jump record when he was at Wingate High School. And also, he just had tremendous range on his jumper. That's the thing that the people who remember him from back then, his jumper, if it was second to anyone's, it was only second to Tony Jackson right around that era. But by the time he got, and really, as Neto said, I mean, he lost his prime years. And by the time, you know, he played a lot of AAU ball, and, you know, when bad conditions, and he played played all over the country like that. And by the time he actually got his shot in the ABA, he was not really totally the player he used to be in terms of overall talent. But at the same time, he had changed his game, he had adjusted his game, and he became this one-on-one marvel. I mean, he was known, and this isn't just me talking or his teammate Neto talking. I mean, this is Oscar Robertson talking, this is Julius Erving talking, this is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talking about. This is one of the greatest one-on-one players who ever lived, this incredible first step. And he also just found this great way to free up space. He could hit from long range, no problem, but he also was the master of sort of the mid-range, you know, the lost art of the mid-range pull-up jumper. And you look at footage. Unfortunately, there's not enough footage, but if you watch some footage and you see the photos, what you'll see is he's always shooting with about 3 feet of space in front of him because he's got the defender on his heels. So, yeah, he was, you know, and again, this isn't me. I never saw him play live. But according to the best players in the world, he was right there among them.
And you have to remember, too, I'll add on to what Ted said. When he came to the ABA, he was 25 years old. He'd been playing, had bad knees, both knees, never had the trainers he could have had in the NBA. He was playing at about 60% of his ability, yet he was 40% better than anybody in the league. So that's what kind of shows you. And Ted was mentioning Donnie playing against him when he was in high school. And an interesting story was Billy Cunningham, who was supposed to be the Kangaroo Kid and a great defender and leaper, and he was a great player, Hall of Famer. They played against each other in the tournament, city tournament in New York, state, whatever it was. And Roger went head-to-head with him in eight-minute quarters, and Billy had 12 points, and Roger had 47. So that kind of tells you he was a pretty good player.
Yeah, I actually have the box score for that game, and I talked to Billy about that, and Billy gives it up to Roger right away. They played on some hellacious junior teams back then. I've got a picture of there's Roger Brown and Billy Cunningham and Connie Hawkins on the same team, along with some other guys, and then Larry Brown was on the team the year after that. So there was incredible competition back in the PSAL, you know, in the late 1950s and early 60s, and Roger there was right there at the top. I mean, he played in what is widely considered the greatest high school showdown of all time, or at least of all time in New York City, he against Connie Hawkins. And, you know, you can just look at the scoreboard. I mean, Roger outscored him 39-18 and followed him out at the end of the third quarter. So he really, and he was very, very humble about all this. But truly, you talk about the list of players who are one of the greatest players that not enough people know about. You'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who's more in that category than Roger Brown. Mm-hmm.
So the second year with the Pacers, 1969 season, you have Roger Brown there, Freddie Lewis, and Bob are some of the key players who came over from the previous season where you had been a roughly .500 team. early on in the season, Coach Slick Leonard takes over, helps guide the team to a great finish and appearance in the ABA Finals, where they lost to the Oakland Oaks, who had Larry Brown and Doug Moe leading the way. Rick Berry also on the team, but he was injured for most of that season. You guys added Mel Daniels, who was the who had been a great player with Minnesota, who came over and won the MVP that season. How did the culture of the team change with the additions of Mel and Slick?
Well, I can tell you that real easy. The first year, you know, nobody knew each other, and it was kind of interesting back then because you never could have put together in today's game. It would be impossible to put together a team like we had because, you know, we had a Roger Brown. We had myself. We had Freddie Lewis. And then we get Mel Daniels, the MVP. The draft would not have allowed it. There would have been no way you could have put together a team back then. But this was the ABA, and people were snatching players. And the story about how they got Mel Daniels is a fascinating story. I'm not going to take 20 minutes to tell you. I'll plug my book we're writing. It'll be in the book how we got it. But Mel Daniels was literally bought in a bar at 10 o'clock in the morning on a paper napkin. And it was probably one of the greatest moves in our franchise history. And I can tell you a couple other things that would have happened. And Ted can back me up on this. Had we not had Mel Daniels or Roger Brown or Freddie or maybe even me that followed the second year in the league, even though we didn't win the final, we got to the finals. But had we not got to the finals, there would not have been an ABA anymore. And people don't know how all that happened. And Ted is aware of it. It's a fascinating story that, again, will be told. But there's so many stories that almost say fact is crazier than fiction, because the things that held the ABA together, it changed basketball forever. And as you can see the way it is today, it never would have been like it is today had it not been for the ABA and innovations. And we aren't going to take personal credit for it. It's just the whole concept of they took basketball like anything else. Everything has to evolve in the world. You have to change. You have to get better. And the NBA was really in a rut. And the ABA came along and forced change. And I'll tell you what, if you look at the game today, the only difference between the ABA and that game today is the color of the ball.
Yeah, obviously the ABA was able to open up the style of play. The three-pointer created, there's a lot of talk about spacing in the modern NBA. But, you know, the ABA helped to start that because the three-pointers were certainly not as frequent as they are today, but it definitely changed the tenor of the game. It opened up the middle. It really did change the, it created a different style of play. And, of course, the other thing was the ABA creating an environment where, you know, players could jump over from the NBA, the salaries would increase, and competition for the best college players as well was, you obviously could speak about some of the other things that the ABA did to contribute, but those are the things that stand out to me as far as, you know, the revolutionary impact the ABA had on basketball that's still being, felt today.
One of the biggest ones was when Spencer Haywood challenged the college rule of taking a player who hadn't been to college over 4 years, and that was something that he went to the Supreme Court and he got a ruling, the Spencer Haywood rule, that they could sign an underclassman, which is fair. I mean, you know, they got 15-year-old pro tennis players. If these kids are good enough to play, they ought to be able to play. And there was just a whole lot of things that the ABA did that was kind of. It was almost like, oh, you can't do that back then, but we did it. And I guess our attitude was tough, pardon the word, I'm glad this isn't live, tough shit. You know, we're going to do it.
I will say one of the things the ABA did that it wasn't supposed to do is that Bob here, humble guy, had the swinginest bar in town called Netto's in the Meadows.
I was going to ask about very that, popular. Yes.
Well, you know, for the brief amount of time that he managed to keep that thing afloat. But one of the things they did was to sneak in a very much underage Spencer Haywood into that bar. Am I not right there, Neto?
Well, yeah, the first time Spencer played in town, he came to the bar, and I remember one of the managers wouldn't let him in because his ID didn't have an ID, and I said, let him in, let him in. And I don't think there was a policeman in town that would have we had more policemen sitting in the bar drinking beer than we did players half the time. So I don't think we had any problem. Another thing we did with the bar, and it'll be in this book we're writing about. We had an open thing that the bartenders and all the waitresses were instructed the night before the game. See, it's not like it is today. They wouldn't fly in and fly out. They would always fly in the night before the game. And everywhere, all the teams would come to the bar because the hotel they stayed in was just down the street. And we had a strict rule, you know, all the free beer they want. And because, you know, you don't play as well if you got a hangover the next day. And a lot of stories also with the lovely – we had a lot of lovely ladies that were in our bar, and some of them were a little shady. But I can tell you one story, and I won't mention any names, but one team came in, and they had one of the leading scorers in the league, one of the best players in basketball came in, was with them. And one of this beautiful blonde young lady sashayed out the door with him and turned around and winked at me as she went out the door. And the next night – I guarded him, and he'd been averaging like 32 points, and he had 5 at the end of the third quarter. And I looked at him, and I said, "You have a tough night last night." He just kind of shook his head because he couldn't breathe. He was so tired.
Yeah, well, I guess take any help you can get.
And I'll never let – you can guess who it was. I'll never tell.
All right, well, leave it to the listeners to speculate about that. But Bob, can you talk a little bit about what it was like to play under Slick Leonard? I mean, my understanding is that he could be very fiery on the court and had some very tough practices and was strict on one hand, but on the other hand, there was also very much a family atmosphere around the team and very much a sense that he, you know, cared for his players and you could go out with them and drink with him, but still, you know, he had the discipline that you needed over the team.
Well, we knew Slick the year before. The first year in the league, he handled our rookie camp, and we got to know him throughout the year. He was, he was kind of a icon in Indiana, and he liked to, let's face it, he liked to have a few drinks every once in a while, but so did all of us. And we had a coach that we started out with, Larry Stableman, and he was a nice guy, but he was a college coach, and he just really didn't know what he was doing and couldn't handle players. And they put Slick in there, and Slick came in with an attitude. He basically walked in the first day and laid some real heavy stuff on us. But he told us one thing. He said he'd run through walls for us. And we had to the point where he would make us so mad. I can tell you, I could tell stories from here to Sunday. You probably wish you couldn't use them on the radio show. But I could tell you stories from here to Sunday about the things he did and would make us mad. And I've seen him make Mel Daniels so mad, the only person that was safe was maybe the ball boy. I mean, he'd kill the cheerleaders. He was so mad at Slick. But he would go out and probably get 40 points in the second half and come in, and Slick would give him a big kiss. But and then after the game, basically, if we want Slick, would expect us. He wouldn't say, "Hey, guys, maybe do it." He would expect us, if we're on the road, to show up in the bar, at least have one drink and talk it over as a team. And that brought us close together. They brought us – we were almost like a family. And I think Ted can tell you that through what he's seen with making the documentary on Roger and with Mel Daniels passing away last year, the closeness we had even 40 years after the fact. And Slick is the one that brought us together. And plus, we really, really were fortunate that we just had a great, great group of guys. And everybody – we didn't care. It was funny back then. Nowadays, people are worried about their minutes or their points. Or, you know, in a one playoff series, we won the championship. I think that one series, the championship series, I averaged like 42 points a game. Roger averaged 42 minutes a game, and Roger averaged 46 minutes a game, and Mel was 40. And nobody cared about their minutes or their points. All we cared about was winning. And that's kind of what Slick instilled in us. And it's too bad. You don't see that today. You see these guys crying about their minutes and getting upset if they don't play in certain games. And God help them if Slick was their coach, because he'd have a baseball bat after him at halftime.
I've heard there was a story once where there may have been a hockey stick involved with you and Leonard. There may have been some anger at you. Could you share anything about that, or should we just leave that?
I don't call it a hockey stick. I call it a motivational tool. Right there.
I think it was a hockey ship, hockey stick shaped motivational tool. Yes.
There you go. Well,
we were playing Minnesota. It was the first year in the league. First year Slick was here. We were playing Minnesota, and they had games around the state, and so we were playing in a game in Duluth, Minnesota, and it was about 300 below zero up, and we were in this gym that had been an old hockey arena. And we were dressing in the hockey players' room. And at halftime, I wasn't playing too good the first half. I'll admit it, I was dogging it a little bit. And he came in, he sat us down, and he lit into me with a lot of words I can't use, maybe 100 of them. And he happened to I could see he was trying to figure out what to do next. And I saw him eyeball, there was a whole line of hockey sticks on the wall. And he reached up and grabbed this hockey stick and came towards me. And I knew I took off towards the bathroom. And I locked myself in the bathroom door. And he was beating on the door I don't know whether he would have hit me with it or not, but he sure shook me up a little bit. But I think I went out and got 20 the second half. So whatever it is, it worked.
Nothing like a little motivation.
Yeah. But the best part of it is after the game, we went out and had a few beers and laughed about it.
So the Pacers were able, and after losing to the Oaks in 1969, they came back in 1970. They beat the Stars, who were still in Los Angeles at the time, who were led by Matt Calvin and Willie Wise. And winning a championship is obviously a great accomplishment, especially with the togetherness that you guys are. Any particular memories of that of winning that championship, or anything during that series that stand out to you?
Yeah, you know, we were all mad about the year before, because people don't realize the year before we should have won it too. We should have beat. We had them down 2-1. We won the first game out there, and then we came back here. And in the first game, we were ahead by 2 points, or by 3 points. What was it? We were ahead by 3 points. I think we were ahead by 3 points or 2 points. 2 points with 5 seconds to go, and they fouled Roger Brown. Now, you figure we're going to win because he had 3 shots to make two. And for some reason, he only made 1 shot. So we're down 3 points. And Slick just said, whoever gets the ball, foul him. And they threw the ball to Warren Armstrong, Warren Jabali, at half court. And he fired a half-court jump shot that swished and set the thing into overtime. And they ended up beating us. And the letdown was unbelievable. I think had we won that game, we might have won that series too. But so we had a vendetta that year.
This is a typical athlete here, right? He's trying to praise you on your championship. What do you do? What do you do, Bob? You're bitching about one that got away.
No, but we had a vendetta. I mean, the first practice of the year, Slick showed us a replay of Warren hitting that shot, and we had a vendetta the whole year. We were going to, you know, bing, bing, bing. And truthfully, I blame myself for this. I'm taking responsibility, and I didn't tell Slick until about 3 months after the fact. Is the sixth game at home, or the fifth game at home, the fifth one at home, we should have won at home. We had all the national TV cameras in the locker room. We had them beat. And dumbass me, pardon the expression, the day before I went out and went water skiing for the first time that summer and that spring, and I don't know if you ever slalom skied, but my arms were so sore the next day at the game I could barely lift them up to shoot a jump shot. And I think I had 17 points. I think I missed 10 shots in a row, which I should have made, and we ended up getting beat by a couple points and then had to go back for the sixth game in L.A., but I blame myself for that, but I was scared to death to tell Slick. I finally told him after we won the series, but had I told him that day, I probably wouldn't have been on the plane. I'd probably been dead. But the first championship, and the thing about it, when we played in L.A., the Lakers weren't in the playoffs that year. They weren't that good, so we were the only show in L.A. We had a huge crowd, a lot of movie stars, and for us guys, it was pretty big. We were really – it was big time, and I know Roger had a playoff series, unbelievable. I mean, 53 points one night, 49. I mean, he was absolutely incredible. And, you know, winning that first one, you know, we won three, but first one, it was the best. It was just something I'll never, ever forget. And I've still got my chat. They only made in those days, now they make 100 of them, but they only gave out 12 of the championship rings. And I've had a lot of these memorabilia people offered me a lot of money for my ring, and the only way they'll ever sell it is I got to cut it off my hand someday. But my grandson will get it. But it's one of the most important things I have as far as memorabilia goes, and all the memories with the guys. And it was just a very special, special time, and it really, the city just loved it, and it was a great time. And one thing led to another. I'll go into another story because I'm kind of talking too much. But when we got back, Mike Storen wanted to have a celebration at my nightclub, a Pacer celebration, and he said, I want to have champagne for all the guys. And I said, well, how many bottles you need, Mike? And he said, oh, get us 100 bottles. He made a big time in it. So I got him 100 bottles of champagne. I charged him $25 a bottle, which he thought was a good deal, but he didn't realize I paid $2 a bottle for him. So that was my playoff bonus in those days.
Well, you smart businessman. You got to make yourself a good deal. You win a championship, you earn a little bit of extra. You guys battled the Stars again in 71 in the finals. They had moved to Utah at this point. They'd added Zelmo Beatty, a little bit of a stronger team, and lost a very close 7-game series to them. And then in 72, added George McGinnis and Darnell Hillman to the team, and you were able to made the finals again, and then beat the Nets 4-2. This is the Nets with Rick Barry, Bill Melchione, and Billy Paltz.
Right. That's another thing that would never have happened in today's game, because here we are. We just won it. We just finished in the championship series the year before, and we end up getting the number one the next day, the next season. We end up signing the number one underclassman in the United States, in George McGinnis. Now, that would never have happened in today's game. You wouldn't have been able to get that high at draft choice or anything. And we tied Darnell Hillman, who was coveted by the Warriors out in the NBA. So we were able to sign guys back then. And George, in my opinion, was in his prime, was one of the top two or three power forwards ever lived. So, we kept adding to this great team we had. And again, you couldn't have done it today's game, but it was a thrill to play with everybody. And just to see how these guys would grow and how good they were. And George just kept getting better and better every day, so it was fun to watch.
Now, were you ever approached to, by anyone from the NBA to jump leagues or anything like that? Did that ever happen to you during your career?
I had a couple feelers from the Knicks one time, and I didn't even call them back. I had no desire to do it. And back in those days, it wasn't the money. Today they only here we'll give you this much, we'll give you that much. I didn't want to jump. I could have. Dick Tinkham, it's a funny story, made a big mistake. In those days, you had a reserve clause in your contract, and they had to, if you decided not to pick up your reserve, they had to sign you by a certain date in September, or you were a free agent. And I can remember at midnight, I was sitting in my bar, and I called Dick Tinkham on the phone, and I said, hey, guess what? Your wonderful general manager forgot to sign me. I'm now a free agent. Well, I think he lives maybe a half hour from my house, and I think he was there in 15 minutes. But you can't do this. You can't. And I had never any intention of jumping to another team. In fact, there was a couple, I'm not going to mention who, I could have jumped to. But all I wanted to do was play with the Pacers. And I didn't care about jumping, and that's kind of the way everybody felt. When Roger Brown had his lawsuit, with the NBA settled with him in the lawsuit, they offered him a chance to play in the NBA. Of course, Connie Hawkins did. Roger wanted to stay with us because we were, we had something special here. And money wasn't the deal back then like it is today, which is, it kind of made the game more pure, I guess. That's kind of melodramatic, but I think it was there was a lot more loyalty back then than there is today. And I can't blame these kids for jumping leagues. I mean, I can't even try making 20 or 30 million. I can't even imagine that in my wildest dreams.
I think people, maybe modern fans, don't have the appreciation of just, what the salary structure was like when you were playing. You could make a good living, but you didn't have the kind of, anywhere near the kind of money that they have today. Of course, the travel was much more difficult. The accommodations weren't good. And, in the NBA, you're dealing with...
First, I'll interrupt you. The first year the Pacers were in existence, the entire payroll for the 12 players or 10 players, whatever it was, the coaches and the trainers, the entire combined payroll was $180,000 for everybody. So you can put that in perspective.
Yeah. So you went to Dallas for a season in 73 where the Dallas Chaparrals, who then became the Spurs, and you were in San Antonio for a little bit before returning to the Pacers. What led you there, and what was your experience like in Dallas compared to the Pacers, which were one of the more stable organizations, probably the most stable organization in the ABA, as opposed to Dallas, which which struggled a lot more and dealt with a lot more obstacles. I think it's fair to say.
Well, that's another one of Dick Tinkham's creative financing things. But they traded. I had a clause in my contract that they couldn't trade me. If they sold me to another team could pick up. I could shop myself around. So when I heard they were going to trade me, Mike Storm wanted me to come down to Kentucky, and I had been playing with Louie and Artis and Dan, which had been kind of cool. So all of a sudden, they come up with this thing where Dallas is buying me from the Pacers for $250,000, which was unheard of money back then. And so nobody could match it. But the funny part, I get down to Dallas. The day after they traded me to Dallas, the Pacers end up buying Donnie Freeman from Dallas for $250,000. So it made me a long run. It was an even trade, but that was the way things worked. But playing for Dallas actually was kind of fun. Dallas is a really, really fantastic town. And I was single, and I lived right up the street from Craig Morton, who played for the Cowboys, and he just opened a bar, and I got to know him. And I'll tell you, I had a great time in Dallas, and Babe McCarthy was the coach. And old Babe, I mean, if you got to play for somebody besides Slick, old Babe was great. He was just a great coach. And we had some fun, and I played there. And then, of course, they were sold and became the San Antonio Spurs. So, actually, I played on the first Spurs team. So, that the quarter will get me half a cup of coffee. But still, it was a fun thing to say. And, I was the first starting center in their franchise history. And I was the first starting center for the Pacers franchise history. So I'm in the record books in a little bitty way. But not much.
Yeah. Well, that's a fairly good history. Obviously, those franchises have had a lot of success. The Spurs, of course, one of the great franchises of the past 20 years or so with Tim Duncan. So that's to be part of that history, even in a small way, must feel special for you. Now, during the as the ABA evolved in the later years, was there ever a time where the ABA felt like secure, like this is a permanent thing, we feel good about where we are? I know the merger was always a thing that was certainly talked about, that it was fairly close in 1970, and there was always kind of the talk of okay, in a year or two this is probably going to happen. So was the ABA, did you feel secure in there, or was there always kind of a tenuous feeling, worry about teams folding, teams moving, just kind of constant change within the league?
I like these questions you're asking me, because obviously you didn't know what happened, and that's all going to be in this book I'm writing with the owner of the Pacers and Robin Miller. There's stories about that. You realize that in 1970 the merger was done. I mean, the leagues merged. It
right.
was done. Signed, sealed. Except for Oscar Robertson filed that lawsuit, which stopped the whole thing for about 5 years. Had Oscar not done that, the leagues would have become, the merger would have happened in 1970, and then I'd have a pension, Ted. but anyway, that's one of those things. But as players, honest to gosh, we never thought about it. We never got into the politics of that stuff. Honestly, in the whole 8 years I played, or nine, I never once thought about the league folding. It's funny I would say that, but because everything, I'm sure the owners and all the turmoil that was going on, and maybe it was because I played in Indiana, because it was such a secure venue, but I never once thought about that. And I don't think a lot of guys really did. I think everybody just saw playing basketball.
But I think I can chime in here and say that there wasn't a single day in the history of that league where there was any great sense of financial security at all. And that kind of goes to what Neto was saying earlier when he said that if the Pacers hadn't reached the finals in 69, the ABA would have folded. That might sound like a kind of an outrageous statement, but you got to look at it this way. The Pacers were, all teams were folding left and right back there, and the Pacers were just like that. And they needed to reach, what was it, the second or the third round of the playoffs just to stay alive. I mean, they were going to fold the next day. And the Pacers, as you know, ended up being the most stable franchise in the league. Kentucky probably second, but the Pacers by far. And without a bedrock team like the Pacers, yes, it's very, very plausible that the league would have been kind of stopped in its tracks. So there was a lot more at stake during a lot of these games than just the score on the scoreboard.
And a lot of people didn't know about it. I mean, like I said, that's why we're writing this story in this book that the owner, because this is an absolute 100% fact. That seventh game we played, well, we were down 3-1. We came back and won the series against Kentucky. But in that seventh game, had we lost that seventh game, they were going into Chapter 13 or 11 or what it was the next day. They already had the papers ready to go. They were folding the team. It was done, over. Now, if the Pacers had folded, the league was going to fold, and basketball would have – it never would have been the same. And it sounds crazy, but there's more than one story like that out there, and it's amazing how little quips and little things happen. Now, the players didn't know it. I didn't know it. I talked to Slick about it about 2 or 3 months ago. He didn't know it, and he was the coach, but all the owners did. And there was just, like Ted said, it was like they were walking on a tightrope every day, but we didn't know it. We were just playing the game.
So later on in around the 74 season, the core that had been there since the beginning, you and Roger Brown and Freddie Lewis and Mel Daniels had kind of a last run together in the loss to the Utah Stars in the Western Division Finals, and then eventually Daniels and Lewis and Brown head to Memphis, and you have your last full season in 75. End up facing the Colonels in the ABA Finals and losing in 5 games. Billy Knight, a big part of that team. What are kind of your memories of the last go round with those guys who you had played with for so long? Did you have a sense that it was kind of coming to an end? Obviously, you guys are getting a bit older at that point, or was it kind of a big surprise when those guys ended up in Memphis?
Well, you want to know the real truth, and again, the guy that did it is writing the book with the guy. The real truth is they didn't trade Mel and Roger and Freddie to Memphis because they were getting older. They wanted new players. They traded them for one reason and one reason only. They were out of money. And I didn't know this, but I do know it now. They traded them for $150,000 cash to Memphis. They hadn't traded them for $150,000 cash to Memphis. Again, the team couldn't have gone. The team was out of money. They were done. And nobody knew this, of course. And we thought they traded Roger Mel Freddie to get new young talent in and bring guys like Lenny Elmore in and stuff. And, comparing Lenny Elmore to Mel Daniels is like comparing a three-wheel trike to a race car. I mean, there's no way. But that's what happened. And again, like Ted said, I didn't know it. We were just players. But the financial footing back then was tenuous, to say the least. Right, Ted?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really kind of amazing that the league was able to kick around for 9 years. And yet out of that really financial mess was a game changer, with the players, with the style of play and anything. And also, it was just a hell of a lot of fun to watch. I mean, I can't go anywhere in Indianapolis. Those people who know I've done films on Slick and Roger Brown. I mean, all they want to talk about are the old days at the State Fairgrounds Coliseum. Where you could smoke then, and the smoke hung low over the court. And those are the glory days here by far. It's not football, it's not anything else. It's pro basketball.
Right. A lot of my friends tell me that most of them didn't see the second half of the game because in those days they'd all bring their little pints of whiskey and order Cokes and sit in the stands. By the second half, they couldn't see the court anyway. So they it was more like playing in a bull ring than it was in a beautiful facility like they have today. But it's amazing. But I'll tell you something. Again, I keep plugging our book I'm writing, which I'm going to plug.
Hey, Neto, you're not writing a book, are you?
here's an interesting fact, and I'll throw it out to you. You might be interested, because there's one of the major reasons the money is so huge in the NBA now. There's one major reason, and it's two letters: television, TV, period. You know, they'd be $2.5 billion starting next year for TV rights. Well, back the first year, the Pacers, they TV'd all the games, the ABA games, the home and away games. They TV'd all the games. As a reporter, what do you think the total television revenue for the Pacers was the first year in the league?
Well,
television revenue.
The only reason I know this question is because I heard it on a different podcast. I believe it was $2,500. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're right. Hey, he's cheating, Ted. He's cheating.
I call it research. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
but you know, when you really think about it, I mean, you think about just the fantastic media out there. I mean, television is $2.5 billion next year they're going to start paying. I mean, it's incredible where, you know, they were lucky to get $50 a game to television TV back when they started. So it's amazing what 30 or 40 years, or actually be 50 years next year, right, Ted?
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. 50-year anniversary.
Yeah, and I hear there may be an event planned for that, which we might want to get to toward the end. But just a couple questions before we get to the end. The ABA and NBA, of course, teams scheduled a number of exhibition games in the 70s. And do you have any do any of those games in particular stand out to you? And can you talk about I imagine there was quite a bit of intensity in those games with, you know, players who hadn't played with each other that much. And of course, you know, just the ABA not getting the attention, and certainly those players wanting to prove that they, you know, were as good or better than the NBA players.
You know, I think that's not really right. That's not really true. Because most of the guys, all the pro players in the summer, we played against each other. We knew who could play and who couldn't play. And when we played these inter-squad teams, I think the fans and the coaches were more into it than the players were. We just went out there and played.
Okay.
There was no hard feeling. You know, oh, we got to beat the NBA. We're better than you are. That really wasn't it. And we won our share of games. Actually, I think we beat them more times than they beat us. But our players were just as good, and they knew it. But they aren't going to admit it. Now, the one guy that would never admit it, we read Arabic. That clown, he hated the ABA. But the rest of the league, they all knew. I mean, I used to talk to players in the summer, and they all knew who could play. I mean, they knew Roger Brown was great. We all knew that Earl Monroe was fantastic, but so was Julius Erving. So, you know, the parity was really, really close. And sure, there were some weak teams in the ABA, but I'll tell you, that Philadelphia team that lost 74 games when they played in the NBA, they weren't very good either. So each league had its weak teams.
Yeah. Let me jump
sure.
in here too. I was very fortunate to interview Jerry West for the film I did on Slick Leonard. And Jerry was one of the guys. He and Elgin Baylor, they came in 1970. They came to see the finals between the ABA finals between the Pacers and the Stars. And they really weren't supposed to. I mean, the NBA head honchos were saying, telling people, don't associate with that league at all. Well, if you know Jerry West at all, he doesn't really like to be told what to do. And they had both those guys had played with Slick Leonard back on the Lakers team. So that's one of the reasons they wanted to go. But Jerry also said, unbidden, he said, you know, I really wanted to go see Roger Brown play. I'd heard so much about this guy. I really was dying to see him play. And he said, and he absolutely lived up to everything he was advertised. I mean, you know, he scored 53 and 45 points in the last two games out there to clinch the series. And I know Jerry, among others, walked away very impressed.
So the Pacers, you know, they won three championships, and went to five finals in just a few years. yet, you know, maybe aren't talked about on the same level as the, you know, as the Walt Frazier, Willis Reed Knicks, or the, you know, Will Chamberlain, Jerry West Lakers of the same period, even though, you know, the Pacers were, you know, more accomplished in terms of finals appearances and championships. You know, I would guess that you think that the Pacers certainly belong in the same category as those teams, even though they obviously didn't play each other, except for, you know, perhaps. I know the Lakers didn't do any ABA exhibition games, but perhaps the Knicks did. But do you feel that maybe, you know, that there just isn't really enough attention paid to the, you know, the accomplishment of that team, that, you know, maybe the dynasty of the 70s is these, you know, Pacers in the ABA, and just, you know, kind of the ABA in general?
Well, I think, you know, number one, media coverage was minimal back then. I mean, even footage of, even in the 70s, even the NBA footage is pretty spotty back then. But I think, again, you got your East Coast media and your NBA, and since the mergers happened, there was a lot of pressure. And I even felt it in the early years in the NBA when the Pacers were in the NBA. It was like they didn't want to associate with us. They didn't want to admit that there ever was an ABA, which really, really aggravated a lot of the players. Roger was one of them. And that's changed. Donnie Walsh changed that whole thing. And but, you know, I think once the league merged, there was this uppity attitude that, well, you know, we'll forget about you guys. And it's going kind of a full circle. And I think, especially like Ted made that great documentary about Roger Brown. I mean, how many people have ever heard of Roger Brown, seriously, other than basketball-associated players? I mean, they've heard of Walt Frazier because they called him Clyde and stuff like that. But who have ever heard of Roger Brown? And I've had so many people that have seen that documentary have come up to me and said, I can't believe I never heard of how good he was. And he was. He was that good. So it was like things like that are happening now. And I think history, there's a lot of history buffs out there that more and more are getting, you know, what really happened. And guys like Ted have gone out and make these great, these super documentaries. You know, Ted could have gone out and made one on Julius Erving, but hell, everybody knows Julius. He went out and did it on Roger, and I think it was every bit as good. I don't know if you saw the Dr. J documentary they did on ESPN, but I'm telling you, Ted's was every bit as good, if not better, than that one. And it wasn't so much the talent, it's just the way it was done, and the real true stories of what happened are fascinating. And I think people are starting to pick up on that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, and it's doing a lot of research for this podcast. You know, I've gotten. By the way,
I don't mean to pump Ted up because he's, you know, he's head big enough anyway. I don't want to pump him up too much. But,
I'm glad we got that.
He's not a bad guy for a Hoosier, I guess.
So before we get into talk more about dropping dimes and to maybe talk a little bit more about the book, I just wanted to get your feelings. You know, one of the books that has had a that has done probably more to you know, preserve the memory of the ABA is Terry Pluto's Loose Balls, which was you know, written in 1990, I believe, so it's been out there for quite a while. And I don't know if you've read it or how fresh it is in your mind, but either one of you, if you want to answer this question, how do you feel about how that book portrays the ABA, and you know, what are some of the good things that it's done, or if there's anything in it that maybe doesn't quite get right, or you know, any feelings you have about that book, if there's anything you know, that you remember?
Bob, you want to go first?
Personally, I thought it was an interesting book. There's a lot, everything in it's pretty much factual. I think the biggest problem with the book is, you know, it's such a huge story to be able to tell in trying to get all the teams, all the players, everything in one book like that. He got the flavor and he touched on a lot of things, and it was really a good book and good stories about the Pacers and stuff like that. And you know, I thought it you know, it's rated one of the better sports books ever, and I enjoyed reading it. But it's like reading one chapter. It's like reading a chapter where there should be 10 chapters, but you can only put so much on so many pages. And that's why I think that we're going to do is going to be like that, but it's going to tell the real, real stories. That I think a lot of people, when Terry did the book, told some of the funny stuff, but they didn't get into the real nitty gritty because they don't, the politically correct crap out there. They didn't want to step on any toes or do this and do that. And hey, guess what? We're going to step on a few toes, but it's going to be funny.
That sounds good. So do you have a title for your book, and do you have a date you're planning on releasing it?
Actually, we do. We have a title. We're calling it We Changed the Game. So I've trademarked the phrase there. For anybody's listening, we have a Facebook page, We Changed the Game, and we're going to start doing stuff on the Facebook page, and we're building a web page right now, too, WeChangedTheGame.com. That won't be ready for a while. But Robin Miller, who's a writer here in Indianapolis, he does tons of IndyCar racing. He's a pretty famous race writer, but he was a Cub reporter with us for the first 4 or 5 years we were in the league. And he was a 17-year-old, 18-year-old kid who we called him the Virgin Harry. But he was a little kid, and he had a lot of fun, but he saw a lot of things, and he got the flavor of the ABA. And then Dick Tinkham, who was the original Pacer owner, he was the original league counsel, he was the president of the ABA, he was the president of the merger committee, and this is the kind of guy that, the mafia take him out and bury him because he knows where all the bodies are buried. And he's got some fabulous stories, almost unbelievable stories that really, really happened that people are shocked. And not just with the Pacers, with some other teams that one morning one owner called right as the season started, and I won't tell you who because it'll be in the book, but an owner called from his duck blind. He was out hunting ducks and called Tinkham up and said, "Hey, I'm folding my team tomorrow. I'm out. See you later." And hung the phone up. Now, putting that deal together took some serious, but things like that actually happen. And so I think
I'd like to jump in here and give this. Bob, if you just shut up for a second, I'm trying to give you a plug. I thought Loose Balls was just a fabulous book. I think Terry did a fantastic job, but I am. And I don't know all that's in the book Bob's talking about, but I will say I'm really looking forward to it because you got to look at the authors. Whenever you look at a book coming out, you got to look at the authors. You're looking at Bob Nedelicki, certainly one of the most irreverent of ABA players. The writer he's talking about, Robin Miller, fits that description for writers and then some. And Dick Tinkham is notorious as much as he is famous. And I do think that book is going to cause quite a stir, not just in Indianapolis. So I for one, very much look forward to it.
Cool. Well, definitely listeners should check out. I just like the Facebook page myself personally. So, Ted, can you tell us a bit about the and Ned, of course, you want to chip in the Dropping Dimes Foundation?
The Dropping Dimes Foundation was started a couple of years ago by a couple of my best friends, attorney Scott Tarter and an eye physician, Dr. John Abrams, who actually was a ball boy with the ABA Pacers as a little tyke. And the goal was and remains very simple. We just want to help. A lot of these ABA players made, as we've talked about, very little in the way of salary. They got very little medical, et cetera. A lot of their, the guys who were big-time all-stars and played for a long time, like Bob and some others did, did pretty well. But there were plenty of guys who didn't do well at all. And they're really hurting. And so our mission is very simple, is we're trying to help these guys who have fallen on hard times. I was brought along as the third board member, probably because Scott and John met each other through fundraising for the Roger Brown film. And we started very small, but since then, it's been amazing. The thing about the ABA, in addition to all the fun drinking stories and the incredible basketball on the court, and Neto alluded to this, it was an incredible brotherhood as well. And the Pacers are, I think, the greatest example of that. But really, it went league-wide. And you can see that in how quickly, we're just a little startup, how quickly we were able to amass an incredible advisory board. In addition to Neto and Slick and the other Pacers stars, it's like a who's who of the top ABA figures. We have Bob Costas, Peter Vesey, Dan Issel, George Gervin, Spencer Haywood, Louis Dampier, Artis Gilmore, and more than that. And one of our really, the head of our table was always Big Mel Daniels. And of course, his passing was incredibly sad for many of us, including, of course, Neto, his best friend. But after that, then Reggie Miller joined as as he took over Mel's role on the board, and that's we feel that's pretty special. But we have been able to help. The most important thing are not the big names on the board; it's the fact that how many people we have been able to help already, and as we've been growing. We are looking to help more and more. And these, there's different kinds of things. With the first guy who came to us, he was really hurting. He was a former Pacer. We thought he would have all of these things he needs. All he really wanted was a suit so he could go to church. Well, just a small thing, but, for a big and tall guy, that's not always easy to get. And he didn't have any money. So we helped him out with some clothes so he could go to church. And we got him a new walker. I mean, we've helped players learn about the pension money they've been due from the NBA. And for some of these players, that was life-changing money. We helped a player attend to the 50th anniversary of his college national championship team. Size 19 shoes. I mean, in fact, and right now we're actually in the process, we're getting ready to fly up a player to Indianapolis, where we will do, full dental reconstructive surgery for him. So as we've getting, we're getting bigger and bigger, and our message is getting out there, we're really proud and humbled that we're able to do some things like this for guys who really did change the game of basketball.
That was Sam Smith that you helped go to the reunion from Kentucky.
Right, down in Western Muskie. Kentucky. He wasn't able to get down there, and so we were able to get him there. These things aren't, it's not like we can't handle everything, but we can, we can help these guys out. We can maybe return a little dignity, and just make their lives a little easier. They gave a lot of themselves, often kind of anonymously, but to a bigger picture that did change the sport and paved the way for these gargantuan contracts you see today. And so, if we can help out a little bit, it, we think it's a pretty neat thing.
I've been trying to work with the NBA a little bit because, the pension plan was supposed to have been had, but there was some mix-up and some things happened, funding and everything, but most of these guys don't have it. There's no pension money out there. There's some little back pay, but I've been working with the NBA, and I've been working with a guy that's a big shot head of the NBA and really nice people. And they aren't obligated to do anything for us, really. But they've been talking to us, and hopefully they did this for the pre-65 guys and give them a small pension. And we're trying to get these guys, a small pension, something that they can, be able to put food on the table and have a little dignity. And so I'm really excited about that. And also this book, I think Ted might know this. I was talking to John. We've talked to the publisher, and we're going to give 10% of all the proceeds of this book we sell is also going to go to Dropping Dimes, as is the proceeds for our 50-year reunion, which I think Ted could probably tell you more about that. That's coming up in about a year.
Well, first let me weigh in on this. I got to get this in there before Neto keeps talking. DroppingDimes.org.
Yes.
DroppingDimes.org. That is our website. We invite everybody to go there and kind of look at what we're doing. The site is still a work in progress. As is certainly a plans for a 50th reunion. We are in very, very serious talks about that with people here in the city of Indianapolis. Indianapolis seems very excited about it. People around the league seem excited about it. And here, I really need to say that we have this is a small market team and our small market town, but we have a wonderful partnership with the current Indiana Pacers. And that has really helped Dropping Dimes immeasurably. I mean, they're helping us reach back into the franchise's past and really into basketball's past. So, again, we're growing. We're very hopeful that this 50th reunion can be something extremely, extremely special. And I can just say that we have a lot, pretty much all of the big name guys out there, not just the big name, but just all the guys, they're very excited about what we might be able to do here.
Well, that sounds exciting. And before we go, is there anything else that either of you would like to talk about ABA history or Dropping Dimes or anything that we've gotten into?
Hey, Neto, I heard you're writing a book, right?
Hey, I hear you're making a documentary on Christmas addicts.
Yeah, I know. No, but I guess what I'd like to say is I grew up in Wisconsin, and one thing we just treasured there was the Green Bay Packers and how neat it was that, you know, not just were they the best team in football for so long, but the players, like another, talk about a small market, that's as small as it comes, but the players, you know, after they quit playing, they lived there. They lived there in town, and they were part of the town. Well, Indianapolis is blessed with the very same thing, you know, here with the Indiana Pacers. Neto still lived here. Roger Brown lived here up until his very premature death. You know, Mel Daniels, unfortunately, just passed recently, but he and Neto could be seen all around this town. Big, tall black guy, big, tall white guy. Everywhere they went, people wanted to talk to him. And George McGinnis still lives here, Darnell Hillman, and, of course, Slick and Nancy Leonard. And it's just neat. I mean, this team, you do not see that really anymore anywhere that I'm aware of. But this team is just very, very close, and they remain close with their fans. So, you know, in all honesty, we here in Indianapolis are pretty blessed by that.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
I'll tell you something else that's pretty interesting, and like Ted can tell you this. You know, the guys on the when we first started getting this advisory board together, we have a partner named Scott Tarter. He's an attorney. Scott does a ton of work on this dropping dimes. A great guy, and I said, well, let's get George Gervin or let's get Spencer Haywood, and they were. He's almost said, well, he won't talk to me. He's a big, and it's amazing how I said, just call him. And you call these guys, and like I called George Gervin up, and I just said, hey, man, what are you doing? And for the next hour, I couldn't get him off the phone. All they want to do is talk ABA basketball. It's like a fraternity, almost like Ed said, it's like a brotherhood. It may sound kind of goofy, but that's the way it is. And Scott was amazed. He called Spencer up, and he said, my gosh, these guys talked ABA ball for me for a half hour, 45 minutes. And that's the way it is. You call Dan Issel on the phone. Man, all he wants to do is talk about the ABA. So I think the more you delve into this thing, the more you guys you talk to from the ABA, you'll find out that it was a special time in sports history around the country, I think.
It was really, really neat. We went down to Kentucky, and Neto came down with us, and Darnell Hillman came down to help a couple of guys, a couple of former Kentucky players. And Dan Issel came, and Louis Dampier came. You know, they're now part of our board, too. And you should have seen these guys. Their faces just light up, not just the guys we were helping, but the guys who were doing the helping. It was neat to see Dan, you know, still just a mountain of a guy, just get in there and really enjoy helping people out. And we're finding that with all these guys. I mean, tell me, Bob Costas doesn't have a zillion other things to do, but he helps out as well. And Reggie Miller the same way. So it's a neat organization. We're young, we're growing, but we are really making some national strides here, and we really encourage everybody out there to give us a look. Go to droppingdimes.org and see what you think.
Well, yeah, I absolutely encourage everyone to do that, and thank you so much for you both for joining the show. I really was able to I enjoyed the stories, and I feel like I learned a lot. Hopefully, listeners, you know, get a sense of what life was like in the ABA, and it's heartening to hear that those memories, you know, have the connections are still there between a lot of the former players and the charity work that you guys are doing. You know, sounds like it's you know, really making a difference and really helpful. So that's awesome to hear. You know, so you hear so many you know, bad stories when it comes to you know, athletics, and to hear some, you know, to some, and you hear a lot of good ones too, but to hear, you know, these guys so many years later, those, you know, those ties still being there, it's just a wonderful thing. So thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at HardwoodParoxysm.com. We are on iTunes and Stitcher if you search Over and Back NBA Podcast. And you can please leave a rating and review if you like what you've heard. And keep checking us out. We'll have more episodes for our basketball mysteries of the 1970s throughout the entire offseason. So hopefully you're enjoying those. Let us know what you think. Can get with us on Facebook or Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So until next time, thanks for listening. We'll be back again soon.
Next time
on Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. The game was delayed for an hour because there weren't enough ticket takers and sellers to get everybody in, which is great.
That's perfect. Yes. That's so ABA there. They're like, uh-oh. Yes. Like, people are actually coming. No.